the gig was over and we packed up our stuff to go back to the hotel, which was a 2-hour drive.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh.
And the guy went to look for our lift and it wasn't there. And then we went to look for the client and he wasn't there. And we found somebody else and said, oh no, he's gone. I'm like, well, how are we going to get back? How are we going to get back? It's 2 hours drive. And my friends had a plane to catch that night. They were going to miss their flight. My flight at least didn't leave the next morning. But either way, they abandoned us in the middle of this place, this like building site of the city, and just left us there. Can you believe it? I mean, like, what the hell? We had to, we literally had to hitchhike a lift. We had to flag a lift back to the hotel, to the city, and get back to the hotel. And anyway, this idiot of a client then also wouldn't pay my costs, my excess baggage. You know, generally don't get that up front because you don't know how much it's going to be, different airlines.
Right.
I've never normally had a problem with it. They always pay it. But this client didn't pay it. And that's bad as far as I'm concerned. That's really disrespectful. And I launched a bit of a thing on Facebook. I thought, and whatever. I mean, I've got a fair few thousand followers and of course, I'm in lots of performers and that's just, someone does that, something like that. I'm going to make sure that all my friends know not to work for this unscrupulous individual who doesn't pay what they've agreed to pay.
Yeah.
He discovered quite quickly and was not happy about that. And I was all like, pay your bill then.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that until.
Oh. Until.
Yes. So this is now some years later, and I'm on my way to do a gig in the same country.
Oh.
And I'm on the plane, and I'm kicking back. It's a long flight. And the air steward comes up to me and says, everything okay? It's like, I'm all right, And he says, are you Sam the Bubble Man? And I was like, yes, how did you know that? Not that famous, And he didn't say anything and he walked away. I said, he smiled and walked away and I was left scratching my head wondering what's going on.
Yeah.
And he came back again and I said, so how do you know who I am? Have you seen me perform somewhere? And he said to me, you don't recognize me, but I recognize you.
Uh-huh.
I'm, and said his name. And I'm that guy that you badmouthed online after our gig that we did. He was quite smiley at this point. He was quite warm and friendly, being quite warm and friendly to me.
Whoa.
But he did say, why did you do that? And I was like, well, because you treated me really badly. You left me abandoned in the middle of nowhere and you didn't pay your bill. What do you expect? I think you can just do whatever you like.
Oh my God.
And he sat there and he took it and listened to me. It turns out that when he's not organizing events, he works for the country's national airline.
Oh.
Air steward. That's just so bizarre to me. Anyway, he did listen to me and then he said, I didn't want to fall out with you and I would like to work with you again. How about an upgrade?
Oh, that's brilliant.
So, suddenly I found myself sitting in business class.
This is Meet the Entertainers, Lai and Big Ben. What is it that we do, flinging ourselves in front of the crowd, caught in the spotlight? Who do we think we are? the multitudes will watch us and our floating spheres of molten rainbow. Here now, and then gone forever. This week, we are talking about bubble shows, and this is the amazing story of Sam Sam the Bubble Man. Let's say that you weren't married, or you haven't got a significant other, and you're in a bar, and some pretty woman comes up to meet you, right? And she says, oh, I work in marketing. And she says, what do you do? What do you tell this pretty woman? How can you explain what you do?
Well, I have to be a bit careful these days. It really depends what kind of mood I'm in and what the situation is.
Yeah.
So, in an ideal world, I would probably just say, well, I'm an expert in soap bubbles, or I'm a bubbleologist. Normal raises a few eyebrows, and generally people think that I'm taking the piss.
Yes.
But it's never that normally that long before they realise that I do actually know what I'm talking about. I mean, having been making bubbles for 30 years now, I do know rather a lot about my subject. I mean, if I'm ever asked on Mastermind, I know what my specialist subject is going to be about.
Brilliant.
On the other hand of things, I did get myself into a rather sticky situation a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I was doing a gig. I've been invited to do a gig here in London for the Spectacle Wearer of the Year Award. Yes, there's such a thing. It's organised by some by Specsavers. There's some, you know, the high street glasses chain. And every year they choose one of their customers looks really good in their glasses, and they host a big charity fundraising event at some huge hotel right in the centre of London.
Yeah, yeah.
And they make it a really kind of big snazzy event. Yeah. Anyway, they asked me to come do like some walkabout and a meet and greet style performance for their event. And what they wanted was a bit at the beginning and a bit at the end. And in between, they were going to do this charity auction and dinner and whatever. Yeah. So I did the bit at the beginning, all went well. And then I had like 3.5 hours to kill before I was going to go back on. So, you know, I hung around the dressing room for a bit, and I was smoking at the time. So I went outside and had a cigarette.
Yeah.
And there was other people there who had seen me smoking, who had seen me performing earlier on.
Yeah.
There was other people smoking. So they got chatting to me, and they said, so what have you got next, Bubble Man?
Yeah.
And there's three women, right?
Yeah.
And I said, well, actually, next week I'm working on the new Bridget Jones film, because that was my next gig. I was a performer in the film. They did a scene in the festival, and I was doing bubbles in the festival. And I mean, you'll miss me if you blink. It's about a second. I did do the bubbles for the new Dumbo film, actually, which that's a nice chunky section of bubbles, which I'm really proud of. But anyway, that's another story. So I said, I'm doing the bubbles for the new Bridget Jones film next week.
Yeah.
And they got really excited about that. And anyway, that was that. I did finish the gig, went home. Next day, I was poodling about London somewhere when the phone rings, and it's the guy who's booked me to do bubbles for the Bridget Jones film. And I pick up the phone, and all he says is, Sam, what have you done?
Huh?
It's like, What do you mean? What have I done? I haven't done anything. He said, Sam, what have you done? I'm like, oh God, what have I done? Turns out the woman was a journalist for a tabloid newspaper here. They printed the story in the newspaper the next day. And the guy who booked me hadn't really thought in advance whether or not I should sign an NDA, and hadn't got me to sign one. And the producers were horrified, because, you know, they try to keep all these things under wraps.
Yes.
As long as possible.
No.
So, to be totally honest, it was absolutely the best result I could possibly get, because, of course, they winged an NDA over to me very quickly after that. They didn't realise I was a potential risk. And at that point, I couldn't say anything else about being in the movie. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was probably the best result for me, because it was about the only press that I actually got from being in the film.
Fantastic. So blink if you miss you. Blink and we'll miss you in the film, but we can find you on the press.
Yeah.
All right.
No, I have to be a little bit careful on what I say to people these days.
Your hometown and your family background. Where are you from? Was there anybody else in your family who influenced you towards your career?
I'm from Brighton originally. Born in the same year as you, Ben.
Yep.
1971. Born in Brighton, which, if anyone knows Brighton in the south coast of England, you'll know it's a pretty bubbly place. It's one of those towns, it's a small city, actually, it's kind of like the San Francisco of England.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's coastal. It's very much got a party, an alternative and party vibe. It's also, of course, it's one of the gay capitals of England, which lends itself to a certain vibe of the city. I still go down there because my folks live there. And I've got some family who still live down there. And I was down there recently a couple of years ago. I was on a little holiday with my kids.
Yeah.
Traveling around the South Coast. We got a camper van and we thought we'd stop in at Brighton. It happened to be the same weekend that Brighton Pride was happening.
Yeah.
And oh my God, I mean, I haven't been there since Pride for donkey's years. It used to be all contained in a park and there was a march.
Yeah.
But it's grown so big by this point.
Yeah.
And they had Kylie or somebody, I think it was Kylie Minogue was playing.
Wow.
They had 400,000 people descend from Brighton. Ooh. I've never seen so many people in Brighton in my life. The whole population of Brighton's only 250,000, so more than what the fucking Brighton. Anyway, it's the kind of town you might expect a biologist to come from.
Yeah, so, puts you in a general area where becoming a biologist isn't quite so bizarre.
Yeah, well, it begins with B as well, of course, which is my favourite letter.
Start my name.
I do always try and...
I'm Big Ben, that's my name, the stage name, Big Ben, BB. And I actually probably know the answer because I've done a little bit of research. But what happened? What happened, Sam, in 1989 that changed your whole life?
Ah, you're wanting to know about my bubble epiphany there, Ben, aren't you?
Yeah.
What happened? I'm not sure, really. Something happened inside my soul.
For someone who doesn't know. Were you sitting there watching, was someone blowing bubbles?
June 27th, 1989 was the date when I first got into soap bubbles. And I was sat in the field at Glastonbury Festival, actually.
Yeah.
And it was Sunday. It was the end of the festival. And it was a lovely sunny afternoon. Approaching dusk, sunset.
Yeah.
Sun was getting low in the sky, beautiful colours. Wonderful festival in front of my eyes, kind of that exhausted, happy feeling at the end of a great week.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this bubble appeared. It was about, I would say, a football, maybe a basketball size.
Oh, yeah.
Down in the valley, especially for that time, pretty decent. It was a little way away from me, and it rose up into the sky. And then very slowly, very gradually, it just drifted across my field of vision And yeah. I was so transfixed by all these colours and light of this floating, weightless ball of colour.
Yeah.
And the way the colours were moving on the surface, I mean, God, it's just incredible. It's just, yeah. you know, when you stop to think of what you're looking at, when you see a bubble, I really don't think there's anything more magical than that. You know, people do magic, of course, but this is actual magic. This is the surely should not exist kind of thing.
Yes.
Like a bumblebee that shouldn't be able to fly because it defies the laws of physics.
Yeah.
It, something like that. I mean, I'm just astounded. I was gobsmacked. And then it did something that I totally wasn't prepared for in this state of mind, which was that it suddenly, completely, totally, utterly disappeared. It just absolutely went from being there to not being there in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. Gone. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
Absolutely disappeared. I mean, yeah, if that's not magic, I don't know what.
Yeah.
So that got me hooked, really. I mean, I didn't think about it. You know, it wasn't like a conscious thing. I'm going to get into bubbles and have a career in bubbles. It was a passion. So I went back to Brighton and I started collecting different bubble solutions. Every time I saw a different bubble solution, I'd buy it.
Yeah.
And most of them were rubbish. Most of them you could hardly make bubbles with, you know. But there was one that I really liked. There was one, I could only get it in one shop. I think it was called Bubble Dream, actually. I wish I still had at least a bottle of the bottle.
Yeah.
And it was an hourglass shaped bottle, which was quite unusual, actually. And it was much better than the others. You could get a nice long stream of bubbles from one dip. You could get, you know, if you lose slower, you could get a nice big bubble, even just from one of those little ones, you know?
Yeah.
And so I always used to buy that. And I was the kind of, this was like when I was 18, 19.
Yeah.
So I was growing up in Brighton, brilliant place to be a teenager, you know.
Yeah.
It was the same time it was when the whole acid house scene was.
Yes, yes.
It was a really good age to be 17 and been living in Brighton. And
well,
I always
like
used to go out with a bag. I mean, I've always been a bit of a man bag kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And before I go out, I would just run around my room, grab a few things, chuck them in the bag, and go off. Yeah, have a night out in Brighton with my friends. And bubbles was always one of those things in my bag. So I kind of got known for that a little bit. Then I went to college.
Yeah.
And whilst I was there, all my mates got into juggling and things. And to be honest, that didn't really do it for me. I've never been a juggler. I can juggle a little bit, but I'm not. It's not. I do a bit of contact juggling, actually. I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went with them on a trip to the juggling shop, and I found this book all about bubbles. And it was like, whoa, great, having that. And that taught me a lot. The important thing that did for me was it put me on a path, because I wasn't able to make, I wanted to make bigger bubbles and I couldn't do it with any of these commercially made bubble solutions.
Yeah.
So I started experimenting and making my own bubble mix.
Yeah.
And now, as you may know, I run a whole company to do with soap bubbles, and we have not only a team of bubbleologists who travel all over the world doing bubble shows, but we also have our own range of bubble toys, machines, equipment, which started from that, because our key product is our Super Pop bubble mix, which we sell all over the world to performers, circuses, as well as the public. It all began really because I needed to make because there wasn't anything out there that could make giant bubbles.
Yeah.
And I needed to make my own solution to do that. It took me about 20 years of experimenting all in all, but eventually we came out of it with our own product. It's called Superpop, and it's great. If anyone who wants to try it, come and check out our website, samsambubbleman.com.
And your company is Bubble Inc., is it? Bubbles Inc.?
Yeah, Bubble Inc. as in incorporated.
Yeah.
It will be the same place, bubbleinc.co.uk.
And yeah, Bubble Inc. was the name. So then that's moving forward a little bit. So moving forward to 2000, I worked as a musician through my 20s. I actually used to be known as Sam Sam the Bongo Man. See, another bee. Yes. See, I'm telling you, it's all about the bees. And I did quite well as that, but it's very hard to make a career out of being an instrumentalist.
Yeah.
And so towards the end of my 20s, I was looking at what I was doing and I was just feeling a bit despondent and just feeling like I'm never going to, you know, I don't want to be a 40-year-old drummer. I knew some of them and I didn't want to be that. And I needed to find another thing to my bow. And so I looked at what I was doing and, well, Bubbles was the obvious choice.
And is that when you set up the stall in Portobello Road in London?
That's right. So when it began, I basically set up a market stall in Portobello Road. This is October, November 2000.
Yeah.
And initially, just selling my favourite bubble toys. I contacted all my favourite, the manufacturers of all my favourite bubble toys. I had £750 to my name. I got myself a little car, a little beaten up VW Golf. Got myself a market trader's licence. I built a little stand. Some materials to decorate the stand. And the rest of the money I put on stock. And I remember the first day of trading, it was a very wet and windy November the 30th, it was, 2000, on Portobello Road in London. And I managed to make a profit of £84. And I thought, if I can do that on a wet and windy day, this is going to work.
Yeah.
And then 20 years later, with 12 Guinness World Records under my belt, very fortunate to be in a position where I get flown all over the world and get the chance to meet lovely people like you, Ben, and as well as on fantastic projects. Like I did the opening Olympic ceremony in 2012, and I helped make a bubble dress for Lady Gaga.
Yes, I know.
All kinds of fun projects that I've been able to get, be involved with, and lovely people that I've been able to meet along the way.
Hey, I don't need to hold this up because you've timed it perfectly.
Cool.
I wanted to say, when you started, you wanted to make bigger bubbles. When did you realise that some people like Tom Noddy, who I saw on Paul Daniels' Magic Show on BBC television in the 1980s, making the carousel and making the, I guess he called it a caterpillar. And I can still remember that. And I don't know how old I was, 15 years old in the mid-80s, watching on TV or whenever it was. How did you realise that not only could people make big bubbles, but some people were making shapes and designs and bubbles in bubbles? Yeah. Because there was no internet when you were starting.
That's right. Yeah, no. I mean, in a way, I think to some way that's, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, you look at the kids, the people coming up now, and it's a lot easier to get that kind of information.
Yeah.
Same time, you know, there's no substitute for the long road.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you're so passionate about something that you really spend such a long time. I guess, you know, it does mean that you learn it on a very deep level.
The question is, though, is how on earth did you even realise that there were other things to do other than making a big bubble?
Well, funny enough, I mean, you know, you're not, I too remember Paul Daniels' magic show and Tom Noddy's performance. Although that wasn't really an influence on me to get into bubbles, although I very much remembered it. And many people do. I often have people come up to me and say, oh, do you remember that
guy?
This kind of hippie guy who was on television when I was a kid in Neighbor State, got a cube and he filled it with smoke. And,
yeah.
And I'm like, I do. I know exactly who you're talking about. He's my friend. And he's a lovely, lovely guy, and he's still performing.
Wow.
So when I got started professionally, and of course, I by that point, I had very much I was very conscious of who he was, and I was very enamored by him.
So this is my question, then. So it was your hobby for 11 years, and then you set up the store at Portobello Road in 2000. But you're selling bubbles, and you're doing bubbles. But how did you make the? How did you go from selling bubbles to being a performer? That's the question. What happened? Was there a turning point? What happened? Because they're two very different things.
Okay. Yeah. So this is a really interesting question. And I think it's something which, well, it's something that a lot of people have commented on that is unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
As a performer. I mean, to actually answer your question, I mean, yeah, I've been a performer most of my life. I worked, like I said, I worked as a musician in my 20s. So it wasn't so much that like there was a transition exactly from going from having a store to performing. I guess the two were combined for me at an early age, really early age when I actually think about it. Because like, so when growing up, my dad actually worked in the city.
Yeah.
He was a stockbroker.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm quite chuffed. He was actually, he was really proud of what I created.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, well, there's a whole story there, which maybe I'll tell you about another time or in a different question. But
I know what you're talking about. Maybe you would feel able to tell me about doing bubbles at your father's funeral, but if we have time.
Let's do it in a different question.
Yeah.
So my dad was a stockbroker, worked in the city of London all his life. And my mum was a creative. She ended up, she trained as a drama therapist.
Ah.
And worked as a creative person in the year. And actually she then set up a film festival here in England. It was originally the Brighton Jewish Film Festival because I've got Jewish roots.
Right.
And, then became the UK Jewish Film Festival, and it's now one of the biggest Jewish film festivals in the world. Which I think gave me this kind of balance.
Yeah.
On one hand of things, I had my dad, who was very much a kind of a businessman.
Yeah.
And my mother was creative. So creating Bubble Inc. is always, always really about performing and selling.
And
two have intertwined in within my business. So when I do bubble shows, we're promoting the products. And when I sell the products, we're promoting the shows. And it's a good model for me because it has been, of course, like all performers, I'm sure you've all had some years are quieter than others. Some years are busy than others. And it often seems to be that one side of my business is quieter when the other side is busier, and they always seem to stand out.
Yeah. That's a fantastic point. Yeah. You've got two sources of income. That's really interesting. Yeah.
But I think what I notice from what other performers in particular have told me and other business owners is that I'm very unusual in that respect, that I'm a performer and I run an entertainment agency.
Yeah.
And a toy shop, a toy company, a retail toy company.
Wow.
And that's something which I think is unusual as either a business person or a performer.
Okay, no one could see me on a podcast, but I'm just going to bow down here because that's very impressive. That is very impressive. Was being asked to perform at Chessington World of Adventures a turning point? I think I saw you at your stall and said, would you perform at Chessington World of Adventures? Was that one of your first big shows?
One of the advantages of doing a retail thing, right, is that you actually, you know, every Saturday, it's a bit like busking in a way.
Yeah.
It's not the same, isn't it? Every Saturday, every Friday, every Saturday, every Sunday, I was out on the streets making bubbles, selling my bubble toys from my stand, and from 8 in the morning until 6 o'clock in the evening.
Yes.
Long weekend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I became known as the Bubble Man, of course.
Yeah.
People started asking me to do their kids' birthday parties or their weddings.
Uh-huh.
And that's how the performance thing started happening from that aspect. And then this PR company came by the stand one day and said, we'd like to talk to you. Would you be interested in having a meeting with us?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why not? Gosh, that sounds exciting. I mean, I wonder what got nothing to lose here. And I had a meeting with them. They said that they've got this client, it's Chessington World of Adventures, and they have a ride called Professor Burke's Bubble Works. It's like a big roller coaster thing.
Yeah.
And they've relaunched it, they've rebuilt it, they're relaunching it, and they would like me to help them with the publicity by attempting to break the Guinness World Record for the most people inside a soap opera.
Yeah. So?
Wow, what a great thing. Some of these people are going to pay me and promote me. And, I mean, whatever. I mean, even without that, I'd love the challenge. So I would say yes. So, I had about 3 months to build and practice, which was, it came with all kinds of challenges along the way. I mean, just building.
Is it heavy to lift it up? One guy to lift up a huge bubble ring with 50.
Well, at the time, the record was 18.
Yeah.
And, it was my first Guinness World Record. So I didn't do anything, I just went for 19.
okay, there you go, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to smash it, I was just, hanging on by the skin of my teeth. Very interesting, but helped me develop what I was doing in a huge way because I was in contact with, I had to make this equipment. And, That was interesting. Except it wasn't that heavy. Like I then broke the record a few years later. Somebody broke my record, and I broke it back.
Yeah.
And put 50 people inside a bubble at the Science Museum.
I've seen the video.
And that was a lot heavier because the Science Museum had a huge concern about health and safety, and they insisted. Funny though, this about this, right? They insisted on an amount of space in between each person on the platform.
Oh no!
With the first record, we just squished them all in there, right? They had to be over 5 foot tall. We ended up actually using my nephew's class. They were just at the right age, so they were all just over 5 foot. But the Science Museum, they wanted, it was almost like social distancing, but at the end of the day, I could have fit 3 times that amount of people. I could have fitted 150 people on that platform.
Because
they insisted on having space around each person, I had to make the equipment so huge that the one group absolutely weighed a ton. I mean, if you put it on a pair of scales, it probably wouldn't have weighed that much. But when you remember that the other end of the wand is a long way away from you holding it.
How big is the diameter of that hoop? Is it like, how big is it? Is it?
Oh, it was 10, it was about 10 years ago now, and I can't actually remember. It was,
Well, let's say, it's got to be the length of a couple of cars, isn't it?
5 meters or something,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I should go back and check. I know I wrote it down. I'd be interested to check.
Yeah, if you're lifting a plastic hoop covered in liquid that's about...
Oh, it wasn't plastic.
Not, or whatever it is. What was it made out of? Metal.
Anyway, the first one we made out of aluminium. Yeah. That was okay. That's quite light. But the second one, we couldn't make it out of aluminium because you pick it up and it would crumple. So
yeah.
Made out of steel.
Oh, God.
It was heavy. It was huge as well. I mean, it was a mission just moving it anywhere.
this brings me to my next question. If you're doing a football show, how do you deal with a problem of transportation? You've got some props. And also, if you're carrying a lot of bubble liquid, doesn't that weigh kilograms and kilograms and kilograms per litre, per litre, per litre?
More the question is getting through security with all these odd-shaped bags.
Right.
Several times I've had to perform small bubble shows for security guards at airports.
To show them that it's not a gun.
And other times I've had to convince them that I'm a children's performer just to stop them from trying to bribe me, actually.
Gosh.
That happens. Yeah. That happens. That stuff happens. Yeah, they look at your bags. They take one look at your bags, like, oh, we're pulling him out.
Yeah. Pay a surprise.
Pull you out.
Through.
And then they're looking through your bags and they're giving you nasty, you know, there's a few of them maybe, and they're giving you some odd looks. And then it's like, well, how much are you going to give us to get, so we release your bags?
Yeah.
And you know what? It works every time, actually. Every time I say, look, come on. Give me a break. I'm a children's performer. Children. and it doesn't matter where you go to. I think even maybe more so, weirdly enough, in countries where they're likely to try and take a bribe from you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to mention any countries' names specifically. But it does happen. I think those countries actually in many ways once they hear you're a children's performer, you perform to children. I don't just perform to children. I do more adults.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't tell them that.
Yeah.
They've always backed down.
Yeah.
Something, you know, it's a very odd thought. I've never thought about it before, but I do think there's some correlation between corruption and love of children.
And just a quick one. Can you carry it all one person, or do you need people to meet you at the airport to help you carry the stuff?
It depends on the length of the show. So if I've got a long run of shows, then I will pre-ship the bubble solution in particular, because of course the liquid is where most of the weight is. Most of the equipment I wouldn't ship in advance. I would.
That
just
was
carry
exactly
it.
My question. Yeah, I got it. How about
I have to make sure that I'm totally covered and we've got all the safety data sheets for all of our liquid and have everything tested. There's an awful lot that the audience doesn't know about.
No, I think getting to the show and setting it up is often harder than doing the show for you.
That's the work, for sure. That is the work. Once I'm up and playing, boom, I'm in my element. That's why I'm doing this, you know. But getting there, absolutely. Getting there, setting up, packing it up even, you know, getting everything prepared. There's a lot of work in creating a bubble show. And it takes me quite a long time just to prepare all my equipment. I will often, you know, one of my bubble shows, I tweak my solution, my Superpot bubble mix in different ways. To get it to do different things. And that all needs to be made in advance. I mean, it's great as it is, but I like the little, you know, tweaking it, that little 5% here and there so that I can make it last a bit longer. I make it last a bit longer by adding some glycerin, basically. For example, you know, I need to be able to turn up to the bubble gig and be prepared.
Yeah, that's a nice tip for people there. Add a little bit of glycerin to make it last longer. Yeah.
There is a couple of recipes on our website if people didn't want to buy the Superpot bubble mix. I mean, they're not as good, of course.
No, but there's something.
But, they're homemade recipes, and you know, maybe if you wanted to. You should come and have a look anyway, because it's great. There's loads of brilliant bubble information. Look in the Bubbleology section.
There you go. Right. I have only seen you on stage. What do you do when you're hired for a walkabout bubble act?
I help people find their inner bubble.
I mean, can you literally walk about with a bit of bubble equipment, or do you have to like stay in one spot?
Yeah, so I do kind of close-up magic, but I do it all with bubbles.
Yeah.
Just like, you see magicians do it. But yeah, I do it with bubbles. So
there you go.
Engage people. I mean, I think I am,
I've got a lot of stories to tell as well. So I engage with people. You know, that's really the trick, isn't it? How you engage with people. I mean,
Stories is good.
With very little actual skill or talent, other than being a brilliant performer, and they're some of the best performers I've ever seen.
There you are.
You know, how you deliver it. I've seen some of the most talented performers, unbelievable talent, but no ability to present it.
Yeah.
In a way that really engages people. You have to have the balance, don't you? I actually think it's more important to have the ability to engage and connect than it is to have the skill.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's the same for juggling. The juggler you want to watch on stage, it's not the most technically skillful guy. It's probably the guy who's got the charisma or the persona or the jokes or something that connects with the audience.
Absolutely.
Assistant or no assistant? Do you use assistants?
I do. It gets a bit tricky when I'm doing international gigs because, of course, it puts the price up.
Yeah.
So what I tend to do, and I know it's not ideal, and I would love to not do this, to have looked into it, but I tend to get my clients to bring in someone local with common sense is what I ask for. To be my assistant. Somebody who I can communicate with and has good common sense. Because I think common sense is one of those things you don't take it for granted. Some people have it and some people don't. And what you want is somebody who's going to be able to be there, support you, solve problems for you. And most of the stuff, I mean, most of the time I've worked as a solo performer to this point. And so I have always, I'm quite used to working on my own, traveling on my own.
You can do it.
Yeah.
Get all the stuff on stage, do the show, get it all off all by yourself if you have to.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I hate doing that. I wouldn't want to take all equipment off stage. I think that just looks unprofessional. But sometimes, I guess, you do have to do that. But I would very much urge a client to ensure that there is other people to do that job.
Yes.
Of course, it does happen that you turn up for a gig and they haven't done those things.
Yeah.
And you find that you can do it yourself.
Yeah.
As I'm sure all your friends have experienced, all your performer friends have experienced in the past. God, man, I had a couple of terrible situations, which I can tell you that.
My next question, what is the best costume to wear if you're doing a bubble show? Your costumes are generally black. Is that a good idea? Is that a conscious choice to make the bubbles the star and your costume black?
So, yeah, I do. I wear black. And black is a really good colour for bringing out the colours on the surface of the bubble. But I also think it's really important that any performer sticks to who they are and develops something from them. I mean, you know, I run a team of performers here at Bubbling. I don't make them do the same show as me. I encourage them I teach them how to do the tricks and how to present it, but I encourage them to make it their own.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important lesson for all performers. The worst thing, the thing that I hate the most, is when you get people who absolutely copy somebody else's work. That really, I find that, I personally think that's unacceptable. I think that's really unacceptable behavior. So if you are going out there to try and create a bubble show, absolutely do. No, I'm not saying don't wear black. I am saying don't copy anybody else's work. Don't copy me. You know, find something inside yourself that connects with what it is and work from there, because
Otherwise, you know what, you're going to move on to something else in a couple of years' time, probably, if you're not genuinely passionate about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's not cool to be, to copy someone else's style or anything like that, you know. Take, you know, it's fine to be influenced. I think being influenced, do you know what I mean, Ben?
Yes,
I think
yes.
Interesting. I'm sure everybody's aware of it. But I think everybody has a different level of what's acceptable and not.
Yeah, and different businesses have different levels. In stand-up comedy, it is absolutely unacceptable to use someone else's joke in a professional show.
Right, right. You know, the bubble community is a bit, it's lovely and hippie a bit.
Good, good.
But it also means that there has been instances where performers have jumped on the bubble wagon and
yes.
somebody else's act
yeah.
Or style very closely and yeah. think that that's okay. And they end up getting ostracized from the bubble community because it's really not cool.
Of course, yeah. How do you structure your stage show? And is there an ideal length? Is there a beginning, a middle, and an end? Is there audience participation in the middle?
I mean, it's almost the same answer, really, to be honest. I structure my show based on my passion for what I do.
Yes.
And everything that I've created is really a reflection of that. What do I think a bubble is?
Mm.
That's the approach. What is a bubble to me, and how can I create something in a show that represents what a bubble is to me? So bubbles, for example, are celebratory.
Yes.
So at the end of my show, I have a whole bubble party section.
A bubble party?
Party, yeah.
There's lots of bubbles, kids jumping around.
Vast amounts of bubbles, yeah. It's a party. And everyone's jumping up and down, loud music, high energy. You know, I mean, it's your finale. You want to do something big, don't you?
Oh. How do you control your music if you're on stage and you're doing a solo show?
Well, that's a very current topic because I'm a bit old school and I just cue the sound engineer, but I am looking now at getting one of those Audio 8 things. I'm sure you know what that is. Which, if you don't know what that is, it's a kind of automated cue system.
Yes, yes.
But hopefully, I mean, the plan is hopefully that within a year or two, I will have a huge team of engineers working on my show who will do all of that thing for me, and I won't.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't it just?
How do you make sure the stage doesn't become slippy?
There's a few ways you can do it. I mean, some people perform on, just put down a dust sheet, put mm-hmm. top in. I will use carpet personally.
Yeah, because a tarpaulin might become slippy anyway.
Yeah, dust sheet's not very secure.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say carpet is really
carpet. So you could bring your own carpet if necessary to the show.
Yeah,
that's awesome. What do you do if there are drafts or winds or too much aircon near your stage?
Pray.
Really? The show must come on. Tell them to switch them off. Close the doors.
It doesn't always work. Quite often, yeah, that can be a problem. because you find that they've got some automated system and if they turn that one off, then they have to turn all of them off or something like that.
Yes.
Oh, God, it's a pain. But
I saw you, when I saw you doing your stage show in Hong Kong, I saw you going on at the start with some bubble guns, and I think you were just seeing where the bubbles were floating too, so you could tell where the drops were.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would always do a wind check. I'm a big believer in being prepared. I like to be comfortable when I get on stage. I don't like to be worried about anything. So.
Yeah.
I will do a wind check. But yeah, I mean, you know, I do also perform outdoors, and in that case, there's no controlling the conditions outdoors. You know,
outdoors, you
get what you're given, which is a whole other way of working. You know, it's you're working with the wind.
Yeah, the wind is telling you what you can do next with the bubble. If the wind blows, you could do a sculpture. If the wind blows, you're going to have the bubbles beautifully sailing across the field, aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked in all manner of situations. Mm. Some of the commercial projects, you know, like TV commercials or something where you're working outside and they say, oh, can you just make the bubble go over there? And it's like, well, I'm really sorry. I didn't bring my remote control.
Talking about your marketing, you've got world records. That must help with your marketing. You've done some. You do quite a bit of TV work, media reports. Does all this stuff? Is any of this stuff particularly useful in getting more shows? I'd imagine the world records must be great for people who hire you.
World records are definitely a door opener. I mean, I've got 12 Guinness World Records now, so, you know, I mean, I think that does kind of put me in a pretty unique category.
That's a very unique category. I'm bowing down again. Wow, it's amazing.
Thank you. I'm more humble than that, but thank you. I think the other one that's been, I guess, well, it's weird, you know. I mean, yeah, I've been on BBC's Blue Peter, if any of your listeners know that.
Huge British TV programme. I mean, it's very famous in England, in Britain.
That also, it's funny. So, I mean, if you go on the programme, you get a badge.
Yeah.
It's a badge, and it gives you access to all these. You can get to London Zoo for free. All these attractions in England you can get into for free, but the actual badge itself has always been quite an iconic image.
Blue Peter badge, very famous.
Yeah. And so that generates, funny enough, that does generate something. It generates some work, and it also is a really, really brilliant way of meeting women.
Brilliant. Sam, we're getting up to the hour. So you're welcome to carry on talking, but one thing we must get, it's so good to talk to you. One thing we must get is if people want to contact you, where do they find you on the internet? What's the best way to?
Well, I'm increasingly active on Instagram, although Facebook is probably where I'm most active. You can look me up as Sam Bubble Man. I'm on all those other things, Twitter and TikTok, and I'm now on Reddit, and oh my God, I think this pandemic has just created this social media explosion, because it's about the only way I've got to communicate my stuff to everybody now. But so you can find me on pretty much any platform, and I'm embarrassed to admit.
There you go.
Or you can come and find my website, which is samsambubbleman.com. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Brilliant.
This was Meet the Entertainers, and I am Big Ben. Each episode takes a surprisingly large number of hours to prepare, record and edit, and check, and re-edit, and re-record, and edit again, and throw in the bin, and mend my computer, and take it out of the bin, and redo it from scratch, and then post it again. So, if you're getting something out of this series, here are three things you can do. Number one, you can financially support this podcast by going to www.thebigbenshow.com/podcasts and making a financial donation of any amount you like. Number two, subscribe or share these podcasts or give me a good review on iTunes. And thirdly, get in touch. I'm always looking for more people to interview. My email is ben@thebigbenshow.com. Many thanks. Talk to you again soon.
My thanks to Sam the Bubble Man, and let's end with one of his happiest stories, best memories ever.
One of my favourite gigs was the first time I went to Jakarta, Indonesia. Mm-hmm. You know, normally you get off the plane, you saunter over to your passport control, you get your visa sorted, you go through, you collect your bags, la-di-da-di-da-di-da.
Yeah.
And then you come through the departure gate and you meet your client.
Yeah.
Right? Holding, or somebody holding up a sign with your name on it, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that person was standing there as I walked off the plane.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And he said, don't worry about your bags. Don't worry about your passport. We'll take care of all of that. Led me through a special channel.
Oh, wow.
And I was out of the airport in like 10 minutes. I was like, what?
Fantastic.
And then I was a bit anxious about, you know, handing over my passport. But, you know, I knew it was my client. So then we picked up the car and were driving to the area of Jakarta where my gig was, driving down the highway.
Yeah.
And all this, you know, Jakarta is quite known for its traffic. There's no underground system there because it's built on wetland or marshland or something like that. And so there's no underground system. And the traffic does get pretty bad. And we weren't driving very fast, basically. And suddenly I see coming towards me this billboard the size of three houses.
Yeah.
With my picture on it.
Woo!
And it was the first time I'd ever seen me that big.
Yeah.
Like, stop the car! I'm just laughing. It was so, man, it's so funny. And yeah, that was the beginning. God, that was just the beginning. I mean, you know, I had no idea. It turns out the people who owned the venue owned this whole area, or look, you're very big property owners in Jakarta, no, the whole, they, you know, streets with you know, like lampposts every 5-10 meters or whatever, and every lamppost had my poster on it. Buses with my poster on it. Videos on roundabouts with me performing. I was there for 3 weeks, and literally it didn't take too long before it got to the point where I couldn't go anywhere in Jakarta without being recognized. I've never had that. I don't know if I've ever really had that level, but I mean, I don't know if anywhere's really made me feel as famous as that.
What a story.
God, I mean, it, you know, and it went on the whole 3 weeks was an incredibly lovely, wonderful experience for my ego.
Best job in the world, right? Sometimes the worst job in the world, but sometimes the best job in the world.
And all the other thing that they did was they printed out all these stickers, like that size of a small record, smaller than a 7-inch, like about the size of a CD.
Yes.
Of pictures of my shows for like they showed 6 pictures from the 3 weeks that I was out there, and they printed them all out, 500 or something of them, I think it was, or 1,000 or something, and they gave them to me the day before and said, "Here, just sign these for us, would you?"
Yeah. Wow.
It's like, well, all of them.
How many again?
I can't remember. Was it 1,000? I don't know. Anyway, it was, there was a lot. It was a lot. So, I mean, there's no way I could do it all on my own. So I got thankfully, like I said, it was a family client, and we became very good friends, actually. We're still in touch with them now. And
you're saying there's people out there in Indonesia with fake Sam signatures on their stickers.
Yes, we all sat around this little restaurant. He was just manically signing all these stickers. And then the next day when it came to giving them out, oh my God, I've never seen anything like it. Like, I mean, you know, they're lovely people and everything, but you give something away for free and they get... The Jakartan people go a bit crazy. And I totally got the stage got stormed. It really got a bit out of control. Like, adults were pushing children up.
Just to get signed stickers.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Brilliant. Should I tell you my Jakarta story? So I just arrived in Singapore the year before, and I wasn't really used to Asian food and chili. It was all a bit too spicy for me. And I was flown to Jakarta, and I was staying with a family in the suburbs of Jakarta. So really, the only food they had was the very, very spicy local food. And they could see that I was having a problem eating it. And so the next morning, I woke up, and at 7 a.m., on my breakfast table, there was a special plate of McDonald's French fries. And they'd sent their helper out really early in the morning to go and get me some French fries from the nearest McDonald's, which this is in like in 1994, so it was miles and miles away. And she'd come back, I don't know, she'd put these French fries down on the table, she'd covered it with a little plastic net, and then they just left it there for about 3 hours until I woke up. So then I woke up, and they were all standing around the table looking really proud, and they lifted off the plastic cover, and there they were beaming at me was a plate of stone cold, soggy, 3 hours old French fries. And I had to pick them up and eat them and go, oh, this is fantastic, guys. Thank you so much. Because they thought, I mean, they'd gone out of their way. They'd really gone out of their way. Without us, they'd taken things into their own hands. They thought, we're getting some Western food. They didn't realize that normally I eat them hot. And there it was. Stone cold French fries, man. Oh, yeah, this is what I always have for breakfast. We can't end without, the story about how I met Samsam. I got the call about 9 a.m. Ben Benner, a performer, his prop's not here. We need you to come to the shopping centre and do a show, do your juggling show instead. The bubble prop not here. This is what happened.
Basically, the airline lost my bags. Disastrous thing that every performer hopes never happens to them, happened to me. And there wasn't enough time for them to find and return my bags before the first gig. And so my client, in a desperate act, took me to a toy shop and said, buy whatever you need. Yeah, are you serious? You think I could just pick a couple of toys from those shelves and do my act? It's not
God.
Like that. You know, I've got specialist problem solutions. I've got specialist equipment. I mean, you know.
Oh.
Anyway, but more fun.
Take care, guys. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.